This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Noir, a novel by Christopher Moore, performed by Johnny Heller. This book is for Jeff Mong, my friend. Author's note. This story is set in 1947 America. The language and attitudes of the narrators and characters regarding race, culture, and gender are contemporary to that time and may be disturbing to some. Characters and events are fictional. Prologue. I did not scream when I came in the back door of Sal's saloon where I work to find Sal himself lying there on the floor of the stockroom, the color of blue ruin, fluids leaking from his various holes and puddling on the ground, including a little spot of blood by his head. Now I am the younger brother of an older brother who often measured the worth of a guy by his ability not to scream under pressure, and insisted, in fact, that if any scream-like sounds ever reached Ma and or Pa, this younger brother, me, would receive a pasting such as I had never known, including severe and painful Indian burns to the bone, a threat my older brother, Judges, may he rest in peace, backed up with great enthusiasm through most of my boyhood. So, first I closed the back door, made sure it was solidly latched, then I glanced through the doorway into the front of the bar, which was still dark, and only then did I scream. Not the scream of a startled little girl, mind you, but a manly scream. The scream of a fellow who has caught his enormous dong in a revolving door while charging in to save a baby that was on fire or something. So when I was finished screaming, I looked around and spotted the big wooden crate in the middle of the stockroom with big black letters stenciled upon it reading, Danger, Live Reptile. The crate was open. Some kind of straw that had been in it scattered around. And then I saw the torn envelope and the letter lying by Sal's dead hand. It was from Bakker, the South African merchant marine, to me, and I realized what the crate had held. I gave Sal Stiff a quick once-over, and yeah, there were two puncture wounds on his neck, swollen like boils, marks of smaller teeth and a crescent shape below that. Full-blown electric jitters ran up my spine and I froze, holding the letter like I just got a telegram informing me I had just been violently crooked. Stop. I didn't know exactly what a black mamba looked like, but from what the South African had told me, they were large and dark and very fast, so I was pretty sure there was not one between me and the 2 feet to the back door, but there definitely might have been one still in the saloon somewhere. I should have called someone. I needed to call someone. Not the police, I thought, since they might be looking for me regarding kidnapping one of their own, and also since Sal took the big nap by way of a snake I bought and paid for, and as I had miles of motive, there might be some suspicion. So no. I could have called my folks, I supposed, even though I hadn't called them since I left Boise. Oh, hi, Ma. I know you haven't heard from me in years, but I got a little problem. Nah. So I thought, hey, the phone is all the way inside the saloon, on the wall behind the bar. The bar, where a giant deadly snake could be napping. And then I thought, perhaps a payphone. Perhaps I thought I should go see my business partner, Eddie Mooshoes, and discuss the dilemma in which I found myself, and while at it, inform him that he was my business partner in a venture that seemed to have gone somewhat pear-shaped. I took a deep breath and held it while I dug into Sal's pocket for his keys, found them, then stepped politely over him and out the back door, scooting his leg away a little as I went, so it would be easier to get back in. Once outside in the alley, I locked the door and sighed, as if I'd stepped safely off a minefield. But when I turned around, there were two tall, thin guys in black suits, hats, and sunglasses standing there behind me. And I mean, right there. It's like they'd been waiting for me. They were trying to act unflappable, but they were flapped more than somewhat by my second manly scream of the day, There are times in a guy's life when he finds himself floating face down in a sea of troubles. And as hope bubbles away, he thinks, how the hell did I get here? I mean, I didn't know then what the two mugs in black suits knew, which was that across the vastness of space, we were being studied by intellects far superior to man's, by beings that regarded us with envious eyes, and slowly and surely were drawing their plans to come to our world and motorboat the bazooms of our dames. Yeah, dame. That's how it starts. Chapter 1 Sammy and the Cheese. She had the kind of legs that kept her butt from resting on her shoes. A size 8 dame in a size 6 dress, and every mug in the joint was rooting for the two sizes to make a break for it as they watched her wiggle in the door and shimmy onto a bar stool with her back to the door. I raised an eyebrow at the South African merchant marine who'd been spinning out tales of his weird cargo at the other end of the bar while I polished a shot glass. "That there is a tasty bit of trouble," said the sailor. "Yep," I said, snapping my bar towel and draping it over my arm as fancy as you please. "You know what they say, though, Captain? Full speed ahead and damn the torpedoes." So I moved down the bar toward the dame, beaming a smile like a lighthouse full of charm, but trying to keep my limp on the QT to discourage curiosity.
"I don't think that's what they were talking about, Sammy boy," said the sailor. "But steam on."
Which is the kind of cheering a guy will give you when figuring it's no skin off his nose if you get shot down.
"What can I get you, Toots?"
I said to the dame. She was a blonde, the dirty kind, and her hair was pinned up on her head so it kind of shot up dark, then fountained out yellow every which way in curls at the top, which made her look a little surprised. Her lips reminded me of a valentine, shiny red and plump, but a little lopsided, like maybe she'd taken a shot to the kisser in an earlier round, where the valentine heart had a cute angina, crooked but inviting. Then the dame fidgeted on the bar stool, as if to get a better fit on her bottom, causing a gasp to go through the room that momentarily cleared the smoke, as if a truck-sized dragon had sucked it out through the back door. It's not that a lone dame never came into Sal's. It's just that one never came in this early, while it was still light out, and the haze of hooch hadn't settled on everyone to smooth over a doll's rougher edges, light being the natural enemy of the bar broad.
"The name's not Toots," said the blonde, "and give me something cheap that goes down easy."
Then there commenced a lot of coughing as all the guys in the joint were suddenly paying attention to draining drinks, lighting cigarettes, adjusting the angles of their hats and whatnot, as if the dame's remark had not just floated like a welcome sign over a room full of hustlers, gamblers, day drunks, stevedores, sailors, ne'er-do-wells, and neighborhood wise guys, each and every one a hound at heart. So I looked over the shotgun bar, trying to catch every eye as I was reaching down, as if I was going for my walking stick, which is my version of the indoor baseball bat most bartenders keep. And even though my cane was 10 feet out of reach, they got the message. I'm not a big guy, and I'm known to have a slow boil, but I have quick hands and I put in an hour on a heavy bag every day, a habit I picked up due to my inability to know when to keep my trap shut, so it is known that I can handle myself. Most of those mugs had seen more than one guy poured into the gutter out front, after thinking my sunny disposition and bum foot made me a pushover, so they kept it polite. Then again, I also controlled the flow of booze. Could have been that. "What do I call you then, miss?" I asked the blonde, locking my baby blues on her cow browns, careful not to ogle her wares, as dames often do not care for that, even when it is evident that they have spent no little time and effort preparing their wares for ogling.
"That's Mrs.," she said.
"Will the mister be joining you then?"
"Not unless you want to wait while I go home and grab the folded flag they gave me instead of sending him back to me."
She didn't look away when she said it, or smile. She didn't look down to hide her grief, or pretend she was pushing back a tear. Just looked at me dead on. A tough cookie. First I thought she might be busting my chops for calling her Toots, but whether she was or wasn't, I was thinking the best way to dodge the hit was to act like I just took a shot to the body. "Ah, geez, ma'am, I'm sorry. The war?" Had to be the war. She couldn't have been more than 23 or 4, just a few years younger than me, I guessed. She nodded, then started fussing with the latch on her pocketbook. "Put that away, it's on the house," I said. "Let's start over. I'm Sammy," I said, offering my hand to shake. She took it.
"Sammy? That's a kid's name."
"Yeah, well, the neighborhood is run by a bunch of old Italian guys who think anyone under 60's a kid, so it's on them." Then she laughed, and I felt like I just hit a home run.
"Hi, Sammy," she said. "I'm Stilton."
"Pardon? Mrs. Stilton?"
"First name Stilton. Like the cheese."
"Like what cheese?"
"Stilton? You've never heard of it? It's an English cheese."
"Okay," I said, relatively sure this daffy broad was making up cheeses. So she pulled her hand back and fidgeted on the stool again, like she was building up steam, and all the mugs in the place stopped talking to watch. I just stood there, lifting one eyebrow like I do.
"My father was a soldier in the Great War, American. My mother is English, war bride. They had their first real date after the war in the village of Stilton. So, a few years later, when I was born, that's what Pop named me, Stilton. I was supposed to be a boy."
"Well, they totally screwed the pooch on that one," I said, and I gave her a quick once-over, out of respect for her non-boyness, if you don't mind me saying. Suddenly I wished I was wearing a hat so I could tip it, but then I realized that she and I were probably the only people in all of San Francisco not currently wearing hats. It was like we were naked together. So I grabbed a fedora off a mug two stools down, and in a smooth motion put it on and gave it a tip. "Ma'am," I said with a bow. So she laughed again and said, "How about you fix me an old-fashioned before you get in any deeper, smart guy?"
"Anything for you, Toots," I said.
So I flipped the hat back to the hatless mook down the bar, thanked him, then stepped to the well and started putting together her drink.
"Don't call me Toots."
"Come on, it's better than the cheese."
"But the cheese is my name."
"So it is," I said, setting the drink down in front of her and giving it a swizzle with a straw. "To the cheese. Cheers." Then I wanted to ask her what brought her into my saloon, where she was from, and did she live around the neighborhood. But there's a fine line between being curious and being a creep. So I left her with a drink and made my way back down the bar, refilling drinks and pulling empties until I got back to the South African merchant marine.
"Looks like you charmed her all right," said the sailor. "What's she doing here by herself in the middle of the afternoon? Hooker?"
"Don't think so. Widow. Lost her old man in the war."
"Damn shame. Lot of those about. Thought I was going to leave my wife a widow 100 times during the war. Worked a Liberty ship running supplies across the Atlantic for most of it. I still get nightmares about German U-boats."
The sailor stopped himself in the middle of the tale and shot a glance at my cane, leaning on the back bar by the register.
"But I guess I was luckier than most."
So after feeling top of the world over making the blonde laugh, I felt like a 4-star phony all of a sudden, which happens like that. But I shook it off and gave the sailor a punch in the shoulder, letting him off the hook.
"Doesn't sound that lucky," I said, "considering your cargo." "Like Noah's bloody ark," he said. "That's what it is. You haven't sailed until you sailed through a storm with a seasick elephant on board. Had a stall built for him in the hold. Poor bloke that has to muck it out will be at it for days. We offloaded the animal in San Diego last week, but the stink still lingers."
"Any tigers?" I asked.
"Just African animals. Tigers are from Asia."
"I knew that," I said. I probably should have known that. "Never seen a tiger.
The big cats don't bother me much. They're in iron cages, and you can see what you got. Stay away from them. Push a bit of meat into the cage every few days with a long stick. A very long stick. It's the bloody snakes that give me the jitters. Next week our sister ship is bringing in a cargo of every deadly bloody viper on the Dark Continent. Going to a lab at Stanford. Snakes don't need to eat, so they're just in wooden crates. You can't even see them. But if one of them was to get loose, you'd never know until it beat you."
"Like a U-boat?"
"Exactly. There'll be a dozen black mambas on board. Those buggers grow 10-15 feet long. Saw one of them go after a bloke once when I was a kid. Mambas don't run away like a proper snake. They stand up and charge after you, faster than you can run. Poor bastard was dead in minutes, foaming at the mouth and twitching in the dirt."
"Sounds rough," I said. "That settles it. I'm never, ever going to Africa."
"It's not all bad. You should come over to the dock in Oakland in the morning and see the rest of the menagerie before we offload. I'd give you the grand tour. Ever seen an aardvark? goofy, bloody creatures, would try to burrow through the steel hull. We got two aardvarks.
Aardvarks are delicious, said Eddie Shu,
because that's the kind of thing he says, trying to shock people. Because it is a well-known fact that Chinese guys eat some crazy shit. Eddie is a thin Chinese guy wearing a very shiny suit and black and white wingtips. His hair was curled up and lacquered back to look like Frank Sinatra's. I didn't see him come in because I was trying to keep an eye on the blonde, so I figure he snuck in the back door, which no one is supposed to do. But Eddie is a friend, so what are you going to do?
Pay no attention to this mope, I said to the sailor. He lies like an oriental rug.
Fine, said Eddie. But as the Buddha says, a man who has not tasted five spice aardvark has never tasted joy.
Uh-huh, I said. The Buddha says that, huh? Far as you know.
Eddie Mushus, this is Captain.
And here I paused to let the sailor fill in the details.
Barker, said the South African.
Not a captain, though. First mate on the Beltane. Freighter out of Cape Town.
So Mushus and the mate exchanged nods, and I said, Eddie works at Club Shanghai down the street.
Who's the tomato?
Eddie asked, tossing his fake Sinatra forelock toward the blonde. I found I was somewhat defensive that he called her tomato, despite the fact that she was that plus some.
Just came in, I said. Name's Stilton.
Stilton?
Like the cheese, I explained.
Eddie looked at me, then at the sailor, then at me.
The cheese. That's what she said.
Have you seen her naked? Asked Mushus.
Now, in the meantime, I had been watching various patrons circle and dive on the blonde, and each of them limping away, trailing smoke, shot down with a regretful but coquettish smile. And meanwhile, she kept looking up at me, like she was saying, are you going to let this go on? Felt like that's what she was saying, anyway. Maybe every guy in the place felt that way. This Stilton broad had something.
Oh, yeah, I said, answering Mushus.
She walked in naked, but I had to ask her to put on some clothes so as not to distress the upstanding citizens who frequent this fine establishment on their way back and forth to mass.
I'd like to see her naked, said Mushus. You know, make sure she's good enough for you.
Not for you, then? The sailor asked Mu. And Mushus nearly went weepy on us, hung his head until a Sinatra forelock drooped on the sad.
Lois Fong, he said.
Dancer at the club, I explained.
That dame wouldn't so much as punch me in the throat if it made me cough up gold coins.
It's a Chinatown thing, I explained further. They have customs and whatnot.
We are mysterious and ancient people, Eddie said to the sailor.
But you have seen her naked, I said, clapping Mu on the shoulder. A ray of fucking sunshine on his dark despair.
On the job, Eddie said. So is everyone else at the club. Don't think that makes it any easier.
Then I noticed that the blonde's drink was low, and it was time I paid her a visit. So I held up a finger to mark the place in Mushu's sulk. Be right back. Another old-fashioned cupcake? I said with a grin, daring her to get sore at me.
My name's not...
And she caught herself.
You buying, wise-ass?
Me? There's a dozen guys in here already offered to buy you a drink.
Maybe I was waiting for a better offer, she said.
Rolled her eyes, battered her eyelashes, then sighed wistfully. Well, fake wistfully, which made me laugh. You know it doesn't cost me anything if I buy you a drink, like it would one of these mooks.
Which means you won't think I owe you anything in return, like one of these mooks, right?
No, 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 I said. Perish the thought. Then I leaned in, hoping to perpetrate a little conspiracy. Although I have told my friend Eddie back there that I have seen you naked. So if he comes over, cover my bet, would you?
I have a birthmark on my right hip, she winked.
That's a spirit, shaped like Winston Churchill. That must be a sight to behold, I said.
How about that drink, Gunga Din?
I like a dame who knows her Kipling, or any poetry for that matter, as I am a sensitive and poetic soul. My dear Ma was an English teacher, and from the time I squeaked out my first word, she steeped me deeply in metaphor, simile, symbolism, alcoholism, and all the various isms of the poetic tradition, all of which have served me greatly over the years in pouring drinks, welding ships, bird-dogging broads, and waxing poetical on both this and that. So I was about to say the same about the Kipling to the cheese, when the door flew open behind her, and in walked Sally Gabb, a.k.a. Sal Gabelli, my boss, followed closely by an Air Force general with so many campaign medals on his uniform that it looked like someone was losing a game of Mahjong on his chest. The bar was called Sal's, after the aforementioned Sal, although there is no sign that says so, and over the years the joint has been known as Flossie's, Danny's, The Good Time, Grant Avenue Saloon, The Motherlode, Barbary Bells, and a half-dozen other monikers going back to 1853, when the place first opened on the same spot. I am told that the long oak bar and beveled mirror back bar came around the horn on a clipper ship with sailors who dreamed of striking gold in the California hills. Currently, the sign read only Saloon, Sal being too cheap or too smart to put his name over the door. Sal was well known in the neighborhood, but also well known to be such a douchebag that no one would have been surprised to see a long red rubber hose and nozzle trailing out his pant leg. The joint might have survived the Great Quake of 1906, but Sal knew that having his name on it just might be enough to bring it down. "General," said Sal, a rangy 50-year-old who was in perpetual need of a shave, wore suspenders and an ill-fitting suit, and held a cigar in his jaw at all times.
"This is Sammy Tutos, my guy with his ear to the ground in the neighborhood. He'll be able to help you out with your little problem."
I cringed a little at the nickname, which only Sal used, and I gave the general the once-over. He was a tall fellow, pushing 60 with a pencil-thin mustache. When he took his hat off, he revealed a jailhouse window of dark strands of hair, combed over a bald pate. "Sammy," he said, as if he wished he had a rank rather than a name to call me by. It would be a low rank, I guessed from his tone, and he just nodded, not offering his hand to shake, as I was clearly beneath his consideration.
"Two Toes knows all the hustlers in town, don't you, Sammy?"
said Sal, who suddenly realized he was talking over the shoulder of a dame and stepped back from Stilton to give her a gander.
"Hey, sweetheart."
"Hold that drink, Sammy," Stilton said, standing up and putting her finger in Sal's face to shut him up, a red lacquered nail a half inch from poking him in the eye.
"I gotta scram."
Before I could say anything or make a move, she kept her one finger in Sal's mug, while she threaded her other hand through the strap of her pocketbook and held it up to put the halt on me, which I did.
"I'll see you later, handsome," she said,
and in a single move she dropped both arms, pirouetted, and slid out the door while her skirt was still twirling, leaving me, Sal, and the general not a little dumbfounded, and me feeling like luck took a powder on me. Lost is what I'm saying.
"Extraordinary," said the general, still looking at the spot Stilton just vacated. "Now, that's exactly the type of young woman."
"A gimp is your guy, then," said Sal, cutting him off.
Just then Eddie Mushoes came sliding behind the general along with a couple of other guys. The evening crowd tended to clear out when Sal was around, as many found him revolting, going back to the war, when he gouged military guys for the privilege of buying watered-down hooch past off-limits hours.
"Catch you after work for a bite," Mushoes said.
"Sure," I said. "Meet you at the club." Eddie waved and was gone. Sal said,
"I told you no fucking Japs."
"He's Chinese," I said.
"Same difference," said Sal.
Now Sal knew his place was only a block out of Chinatown, and that the Chinese were in San Francisco long before the Italians, and that his Italian fishermen ancestors had been selling fish to Mushu's Chinese forefathers for 5 generations. But he chose to ignore that in favor of showing his patriotism to the general with indiscriminate discrimination. "But the douchebag is my boss, and he gave me a job after the war, when jobs were not easy to come by, and under somewhat phonus balonus circumstances that I would rather not have revealed to the general public, and law enforcement in particular. So I let it pass."
"What can I get you, General?" I said, looking past Sal.
"Scotch, neat, single malt if you have it."
He looked around the joint and assessed it as the kind of place that wouldn't have a single malt. Most bars these days don't. The Scots had to suspend distilling it during the war, and it's not a quick process. But I remembered seeing something. I'll see what I can find. As I rummaged around under the bar, Sal said,
"General Remy's just in town for a few days, meeting with some mucky mucks, but he's coming back next week."
"I'm hoping to make some arrangements for some social company upon my return."
For a military guy, the general seemed a little uncomfortable being in a bar. Maybe it was just Sal's bar. And how those two ended up together was a mystery to me as well. Sal said, The general is commander of a base back east.
Oh, really? I said. My head still down with the spiders and the dust looking for Scotch. Where is that?
Roswell, New Mexico, said the general.
There it is. I popped up from under the bar with a dusty bottle of Glenfiddich. Never heard of it.
No reason you would, said the general. Nothing ever happens there.
Right, I said, uncorking the bottle. Double?
Please, said the general.
So I poured, thinking not at all about New Mexico, but about the cheese, and how she walked out without my getting her number, or even finding out if she lived in the neighborhood, and wondering if she'd just jitterbugged out into the great beyond, never to be seen again. But then I thought, no. She stood up, and stood up to Sal on my behalf. And even though I didn't know where she came from, where she went to, or how to find her, it felt like I was going to see her again. And when I did, something was going to happen. Something big and strange and hopeful. And there wasn't a goddamn thing I could do about it.
Chapter 2 Tall House of Happy Snake and Noodle.
The fog lay spread across the city like a drowned whore. Damp, cold, smelling of salt and diesel. A sea-sodden streetwalker who just bonked a tugboat.
"Fog's a little slutty tonight," said the cabbie, leaning against his hack at the curb outside Sal's.
A foghorn moaned out in the bay. Sammy flipped his coat collar up until it met the brim of his hat.
"A little tart," he agreed.
"Take you somewhere?"
"Now I'm just heading down a few blocks." Sammy pointed across Broadway, which was the border between North Beach, the Italian neighborhood, and Chinatown.
"Thanks."
The cabbie tipped his leather cap.
"Cookies later?"
"Maybe," Sammy said. He made his way across the deserted boulevard. The streetlights floated above in the vaporous auras like lost spirits, never reaching the pavement. The shops on Grant Avenue, groceries, souvenir stands, restaurants, butchers, were dark except for the odd stripe of neon, cutting the night here and there. Closed. Massage. A Coca-Cola sign. A happy glowing dragon holding a bowl of chop suey. It was only 7 blocks from Sal's to Club Shanghai, where Eddie worked. Not even half a mile. But after 3 blocks, the damp and cold made Sammy's foot ache, and he'd wished he'd taken the cabbie up on his offer. June gloom in the city. Or as Mark Twain had put it, summer in Frisco makes a guy want to snatch a flounder up by the lapels and slap the damp off of him. One of Twain's lesser-known quotes. As he paced his path out with his walking stick, Sammy thought about the Stilton dame, the cheese. Something about her. Not that she wasn't easy on the eye, she was. Although not a knockout, but kind of sweet-looking. The type of broad you could take home to Mom, then ravage in the spare room under urgent whispers while Mom harumphed her disapproval to Dad about just what manner of floozy would allow herself to be named after a stinky English cheese. In short, he liked her. And by getting up and putting the chill on Sal and General Remy when she did, she'd showed him a kindness, although a sneaky and crooked kindness, which he also liked. He wanted to see her again, and he was a little sad he didn't know how to make that happen, other than by showing up for work and hoping she came in. When he stepped into the deep carpet and red velvet elegance of Club Shanghai, Sammy saw Eddie Mushu standing at the host station next to a younger guy in a tux, who was working the book. It was 2:30 in the morning, and while the band was on break, a Glenn Miller record was playing. Smoke and the sound of conversation were streaming out of the club's big main room.
"Hey, Sammy," Eddie called. "You met Lou?"
"Low," the kid corrected.
"He's learning," Eddie said with a grin.
None of the employees at Club Shanghai used his Chinese name, the entire theme of the club being Asian players and Anglo roles, which had kept Shanghai and a half dozen other clubs of its type going strong through much of the Depression and all of the war. Sammy was shaking the kid's hand when Lois Fong tiptoed up, in a gold pair of pin-up Mary Janes, in a sequined gold sheath of an evening gown unzipped to the small of her back.
"Be a doll, Eddie, would you?"
she said, presenting the creamy V of her back for his ministry. Eddie worked the zipper half-heartedly, like he was closing the casket on an erotic dream, then patted her on the bottom to signal the deed was done.
"Here you go, kiddo," Eddie said.
Lois pouted at him over her shoulder.
"Not all the way, sweets. A girl's got to show a little sample."
Now Eddie pouted as he pulled the zipper back down a couple of inches.
"Thanks, pal," she said.
She kissed the air by his cheek and ran her fingernail under his chin as she scampered off toward the lounge. Sammy cleared his throat. Hey, Eddie, if you want to stay and take care of business, we can catch a bite another time.
Nah.
Eddie pulled some keys from his pocket and threw them on the host stand.
She says I cramp her style when she's working the lounge. Let me get my coat. What's it like out there?
Chilly, Sammy said.
Yeah, and here too, said Eddie.
They walked side by side up Grant Avenue until Eddie took a sharp right into an alley.
Shortcut? Sammy asked.
Normally they went to Cookie's Coffee, a diner in the Tenderloin, one of the few places open all night. But Eddie was headed in the wrong direction.
New place, said Mooshoes.
He dodged between trash cans and abandoned crates, and Sammy did his best to follow, navigating in the haze by trying to stay on the dim shine of wet bricks, like trying to follow a stream of black oil through a maze of shadows. The smell of fish and rotting onions clung like cobwebs, letting go for a brief few seconds when they stepped out into Kearney Street, before Eddie dove down another alley.
Moo, are you taking me someplace to murder me? Because I'd prefer to be croaked someplace a little less dank.
Relax, we're here. Eddie pointed down the alley to a small curl of orange neon that flickered open, buzzing like a dying bee, next to a battered red metal door.
You said you wanted to learn about Chinese culture.
You keep it in this dump? Sammy looked at the doorway. It led into a brick building jammed between two other buildings, the entire structure no more than 8 feet wide, but going up the same four full stories as the buildings flanking it, as if someone had seen a very narrow alley and thought, now that's a place I'd like to stack some bricks, a place where they can't possibly fall over. Eddie pulled the door open, releasing a rush of yellow light, steam, tobacco smoke, and a cloud of vapor that Sammy would identify later as the odor of dusty old guy. He didn't know how he knew that, but that's what it put him in mind of. Inside, he could see a long counter running all the way to the back of the building, ending at what looked like a dumbwaiter hatch. Along the counter sat a row of perhaps 30 very old Chinese guys, dressed in everything from traditional silk jackets to yellow fisherman's macks, but most in dark western wool suits. They were either hunched over steaming bowls of soup or smoking pipes and cigarettes, most of them so wrinkled and desiccated they could have been constructed entirely of scrotal skin. A younger guy in an apron was making his way up and down the service side of the counter, carrying a big steaming pot and a ladle. A dozen of the old guys looked to the door.
Guailo,
one of them muttered.
Guailo.
The rest mumbled down the line, then turned their attention back to their soup.
What's that?
Sammy whispered.
Nothing, follow me.
Eddie took a step into a very narrow stairwell to his left. He listened for a second before ascending the stairs. Four steps up, turn. Four steps, turn. Four steps, turn. It was like climbing a staircase in a phone booth. They emerged into another long, narrow hallway with another counter inhabited by more old Chinese guys, although this bunch seemed somewhat younger than the nutsack crew below. Sammy was the only Anglo in the joint, but he was used to being the outsider, so he just followed Eddie's lead.
Guailo,
several of the old guys mumbled, before going back to their conversation or their soup.
What? What?
Said Sammy.
There's two empty stools, Eddie said,
shimmying behind the diners. When they were seated in the middle of the counter, so tight their shoulders were touching along their neighbor's shoulders on either side, another guy in an apron came by with his steaming pot and ladle and said something in Cantonese to Mooshoes.
You want soup or noodles?
Eddie asked.
I want a cheeseburger, Sammy said.
Eddie said something to the apron guy who tossed a couple of empty bowls, chopsticks, and spoons in front of them, then skulked away, muttering.
We're having noodles, Eddie said.
Sammy looked around at various old guys' soups.
The fuck is juke?
It's rice porridge, very hearty. This place is a juke house. Been here since we built the railroad. Guys working, runs in here, slurps some juke, maximum food, minimum time.
And we're here instead of cookies because?
Culture?
Mooshoes ventured. Yeah, no, Sammy said.
My grandmother said the juke warms the heart,
which is why we're having noodles.
Fine, Eddie said. I want to go back to the club when Lois gets off at 4, and I'm hungry, and this is the only place open in Chinatown this time of night.
You could have just waited for her.
I would have loved to,
but the ponies are encouraged to hang out with patrons in the lounge between and after shows. She thinks I'm going to get in the way of her finding some rich Guai Lo sugar daddy.
Wait, what's Guai Lo? That's what all those guys said when we came in.
Ah, it means new friend.
I don't think so, said Sammy. The old guy next to Sammy leaned over and said,
White devil.
No, said Eddie. Don't listen to him, he doesn't even speak English. Can mean ghost person, said the old guy on the other side of Moo. Sammy looked from one geezer to the other.
Hey, screw you guys, I'm not a white devil.
Calm down, said Moo Shoes. It's just an expression. No one thinks you're actually a white devil.
White devil very touchy, said the old guy next to Sammy.
Sammy turned to the geezer and balled his fist under his chin. The old guy grinned. Maybe 6 teeth total. Sammy laughed and patted the old guy's shoulder.
Yeah, a little too touchy, Pops.
To Eddie, he said. So you're going to go back to the club just in time to see her leave with some white devil?
I hope not. I just want to be there, you know. Throw the dice. Maybe my number comes up one of these nights. I got it bad for her, Sammy. I guess maybe I'm just a sap.
Moo hung his head, fixing his eyes on the beat-up wooden counter, as noodles were ladled into their bowls. Sammy doctored his noodles with soy sauce and some chili paste, then blew on them to give himself time to think. In this nighttime world, where everyone was on some kind of hustle, looking for some kind of angle, a guy seldom let his guard down. So when a pal opened up like Eddie just had, when a guy showed he needs sympathy, put his half-broken heart out there for another guy to see, he needed to be handled gently, very much like a fragile little baby bird that has fallen out of the nest.
Moo Shoes, you're a goddamn idiot.
What?
Said Moo.
No.
Maybe, why?
That doll has more angles and she's got curves, and you know it. If a guy is going to wreck his life on a dame, it should at least be a surprise. Putting the chill on you is the biggest favor Lois has ever done you.
And Moo Shoes launched into a soliloquy on the beauty, charm, and perfect astrological alignment, monkey rat of Lois Fong, and how he, a third son of a launderer, wasn't worthy of the attention of such a creature. Out of respect, Sammy tuned him out and concentrated on his noodles, which were quite tasty indeed. He watched the juke guy take orders and collect empty bowls, then shamble down the narrow aisle to the end of the counter, where he deposited them in the dumbwaiter. He closed the hatch and pulled a cord, which must have rung a bell somewhere. A few minutes later, the dumbwaiter returned with another steaming pot and stack of clean bowls.
This broth is tops, said Sammy.
Chicken? You haven't even been listening.
I have. You are longing for Lois Fong, who thinks you are shit on a stick. Hold the stick. Right?
No, Lois likes me. She says I make her laugh.
Well, I'm no dame, but you are a snazzy dresser, and you are not completely horrible to pass an hour with. So it seems to me that Lois does not realize what she is missing. You are a diamond in the rough, Moo.
I got no car, no house, and I share an apartment with 4 other guys.
And you're often more than so much short of folding money as well.
My people like to gamble, explained Moo. Luck is a big thing in Chinese culture.
I am paying for the noodles, I take it.
How about this broth, huh?
Moo Shoes slipped some broth from a big porcelain spoon.
Delicious, huh? Huh?
Sammy looked up from chasing some noodles around his bowl with a chopstick. Lois put the bite on you for your tips tonight?
Parrot. She has expenses. I'll pay you back Friday.
The old guy next to Eddie tapped him on the shoulder.
You too, Eddie said.
Then to Sammy.
I started a craps game here last Monday, thinking that my venerated elders are new to the game. But gambling is gambling, and they are Chinese, so they will be happy to part with some of the cash as part of the price of learning.
Didn't go well? Eddie leaned in at Sammy and whispered.
These old fuckers are fast learners. Look, I have cash, but I can't let these guys know it.
Eddie picked up his own chopsticks and showed Sammy the grip.
You need to use both chopsticks. Here, like this. I thought I showed you. See, you just move the one.
Sammy mimicked Eddie's move and managed to strangle a couple of innocent noodles. When the counter guy came by again, Sammy paid him for the soup. Eddie said,
What was the deal with the brass with Sally Gabb tonight?
Runs an airbase in New Mexico. I don't know where Sal found him, but he thinks I can find him some broads for a campout he's having next week with the Bohemians.
So I decided not just go to Mabel's on Post Street and arrange for some girls to be delivered. I am guessing that it is not the first time she does business with the Bohemian Club.
Not just the thing. A general does not want professionals. He wants normal dames. What you might meet at the butcher shop or on a train. In cotton dresses and smelling of ivory soap. So that the Bohemians can feel that it is their charm and not their money that causes the girls to surrender their knickers.
Even though the normal girls will be paid to come to the camp out?
That is what I gather. The general feels that bringing normal Bettys who go moony over the old rich and powerful Bohemian guys will put them in a most favorable light with their club.
Which he is not one of.
Mushu shoveled a tangle of noodles over the edge of his bowl into his mouth with a slurp. I gather that this is the whole reason he concocts his caper. It seems that despite the many ranks and medals and airmen under his command, the general is regarded by the Bohemians as strictly a guest. But once he provides them with a gaggle of dolls to dote upon them and be impressed and perform further nasties to their own free will, he will be in. Eddie let some noodles slide back into his bowl as he looked up to see if Sammy was yanking his chain.
He tells you this?
No, this part I pieced together while cleverly spying from my position 2 feet away across the bar, a place where, evidently, I am completely invisible, unless they need something from me.
Douchebags?
That would be my assessment, yes, said Sammy.
That's the stupidest goddamn thing I've ever heard.
Also correct. And that's saying something, considering the lowest Fong variable.
And Sal comes to you for the service because...
I am extraordinarily charming.
If a guy goes through life as Sal Cabelli, sure, I can see how he'd think that.
And I am loaded with street smarts.
And as someone eating noodles you are paying for, I would have to agree there as well.
And I know many citizens, many of them dames.
All of them Sal also knows, but it wouldn't take a leak on him if he was dying of thirst.
True, Sammy said.
And you are going to accomplish this roundup of normal Bettys and calico and pigtails and whatnot.
Judy Garland in The Wizard of Oz was mentioned, Sammy said.
You are going to round up these Dorothys, Hal?
I'm going to go to Mabel's on Post Street with a generous stack of the General's doubloons and arrange to have a few of her most Dorothy-like girls scrubbed up and pigtailed and asked to refrain from swearing or disrobing until the Bohemians are well in the bag, which I am told is early in their campout.
That might work.
It will for Mabel and the girls, and I will keep my august position behind the bar, as well as keep Sal from rolling on me to the cops and sending me to prison for an extended stay, Sammy thought.
You know, Janet Chang at the club can sing the shit out of Over the Rainbow.
I'm not yet clear Sal is going to be there, Moo, and we know how he feels about persons of the ornamental persuasion. But if he's not there and she wants to spend a weekend oiling old rich guys... I think we can find a spot for her on the bus.
A whole busload of whores.
Eddie looked up toward the smoke-stained ceiling like he was receiving a vision from the patron saint of Nookie.
And Toto, too, said Sammy. And for this you will be paid in the amount of...
I told you, I get to keep my job, said Sammy.
And out of prison.
He really should tell Moo.
And for this Sally Gabb and his tin soldier chased away that luscious doll at the end of the bar?
The cheese, Sammy provided.
Exactly,
said Eddie Mooshoes.
Not only are you pimping for free, you are upside down by one delicious cheese at the hands of that Dago fuck. Is this a bad deal, Sammy?
When I think of all the guys down on 3rd Street eating Salvation Army soup, I think keeping my job is not such a bad deal. And besides, I think I will see the beauteous cheese again.
You got a phone?
Not in full.
You got some of a phone?
Nah, but she says she will see me later.
Oh, well, you should have said. I'll see you later is as sure a bet as the sun rising in the east. I would give 6 to 5 on a see you later.
No one cares for your sarcasm, Mooshoes.
Look, said Eddie, tossing his head toward the dumbwaiter at the far end of the counter. You gotta see this.
A buzz moved through the room. Excited exclamations and Cantonese that sounded to Sammy like someone throwing a drawer full of silverware down the stairs. As the dumbwaiter hatch opened, it revealed a glass box, perhaps 2 feet wide and 3 feet high, and in it squirmed dozens of very active snakes, all struggling to get above the 3 or 4 inches of liquid at the bottom of the aquarium. Eddie said something to the old guy next to him in Cantonese, and the old guy rattled something back that sounded like someone assaulting a broken banjo. The old guy's eyes lit up, and he started digging in his pants pockets in a manner most frantic. The guy in the apron wrestled the box of snakes out of the dumbwaiter and onto the counter, then went back for another huge pot of noodles. Another apron guy came up the steps and joined the first guy and scooped steaming noodles and broth into a bowl. "You guys gonna eat those snakes, aren't you?" Sammy whispered to Moo. "Just watch." The old guys had all pulled bills out and were waving them in the air at the noodle guy, like guys calling out bets at a craps game. The guy with the glass box opened the hinged lid, and the snakes all struck at his hand, missed, then slid back down into the liquid. He took a very long ladle with a bowl that held maybe a jigger, reached into the tank, scooped some of the amber liquid from the bottom, and poured it over the noodles the other guy was holding. The noodle guy then ran down the counter to the farthest guy and delivered the bowl to an ecstatic old man, then snatched a $20 bill out of the old guy's hand.
"Snake piss," Eddie said, all but giggling.
Sammy watched the process again as a bowl of noodles and whiz went by.
$20, Sammy said. "A double sawbuck for a scoop of snake piss? Don't these guys know there's a war on?"
"There's not a war on anymore," said Eddie, reveling in Sammy's dismay.
"Yeah, but I don't have another saying, and this is the daffiest thing of all the daffy things you have pulled on me."
The old guy next to Sammy tapped him on the shoulder and said something in Cantonese while pointing at his crotch.
"He says we'll give you the dick of death," Eddie translated.
The old guy grinned, stood, pushed his crotch against Sammy's shoulder and twanged something in Cantonese again.
"He says it gives you a shaft of steel," Eddie translated.
The old guy bumped against Sammy's arm.
"He says feel it."
"I don't want to feel it," Sammy said. "Sit down, Pops, before I'm forced to loosen your last tooth. Eddie, tell him to get his wang off of me." Eddie did, and the old guy did, just as his noodles and snake piss arrived, which the old guy dug into. Sammy looked at Eddie.
"So that works? Feel for yourself."
Sammy started to stand, and Eddie pushed him back down.
"Relax, old Chinese guys will eat and drink all kinds of weird stuff to get a boner. The stranger and more deadly, the better. Those snakes are sea snakes, the most deadly in the world, so they give the best boners. But I've seen them with coral snakes, rattlesnakes, a cobra once. The more deadly, the better stiffy.
But they're paying $20 a piece to slurp piss?"
$20 a scoop. Some really old guys get 2 or 3 scoops. It's not all that bad. They feed the snakes nothing but beer for a couple of weeks to purify them before they bring them in here."
"How do they get the snakes to drink the beer?" Sammy asked.
Mushu shrugged.
"Free pretzels?"
Big grin. "Mushu, you are both a mook and a jamook. You, sir, are a jamook." Sammy did a quick count of the guys at the long counter. There were around 40, and all of them, except him and Eddie, were waving 20s or slurping snake whiz.
"So there's a counter like this on every floor?"
"Yeah," said Moo. "All the cooking and dishwashing is done in the basement."
"And it's like this every night? With the snakes and everything?"
"Not always. Only when they can get the snakes. They don't live a long time in that glass box, but yeah, when they have them, all 4 floors are full from midnight on."
Sammy did some quick calculating, scratched his chin, then stood up. "I gotta go, Moo."
"Ah, shucks, Sammy. I didn't mean to chase you off. You know I love sharing Chinese culture with you, just to see you get the Guai Lo heebie-jeebies."
"No, it's not that. I want to get home and catch 20 or so winks. I'm going to head over to the docks in Oakland in the morning. I need to see a guy."
"In the morning? In the AM, really?"
"They were nighttime guys."
"Yeah, I can do it. I've done it before.
I think I got an angle on something."
"Okay, Sammy, thanks for the noodles. You want me to put the word out to find the cheese dame?"
"Sure, but keep it on the sly. I don't want to scare her off."
The old guy next to Sammy grabbed his crotch and said something in Cantonese.
"He says you can give it a squeeze before you go,"
Eddie translated.
"Tell him thanks, but I'm good," Sammy said.
"Eddie, can I have a word outside?"
"Sure," said Mushus.
He followed Sammy down the stairs and out into the alley.
"I need to borrow $100, Sammy said.
"I just told you, I'm broke."
"Yeah, and I backed you up because you were saying it for the benefit of those old guys. But I got an angle on something, and I need to borrow $100. This works out, you're in for half."
Eddie looked over his shoulder, then all around the alley, before pulling a money clip out of his pants pocket.
This leaves me with $10 to last the rest of my life. What if Lois wants to go out later?
Sammy took the money and pocketed it. He said, Moo, a guy can't throw a stick in Chinatown without hitting a young doll with potential, and odds are that she will pick up the stick and make a delicious soup from it. So as a pal, let me advise you to leave Lois Fong to the White Devils and go for one of them.
First, most Chinese dolls' families won't let them have anything to do with someone like me who works in a nightclub. And second, you don't know what it is to have it bad for a dame. But you will, then we'll talk.
Fine, Sammy said. Thanks for the loan. I gotta go see a guy about a snake.
Chapter 3 The Kid. Around noon, the kid clocks me with a pillow, and I come awake to a room that is unpleasantly bright, even with all the shades pulled. Anyways, I am sleeping the sleep of the mostly innocent when the kid jumps in the bed astraddle me and starts pummeling away on my melon with a sack of feathers, like he's trying to beat out a fire, while shouting thusly, Get up, you mug! Whack! You mook! Whack! You lazy bum! Whack! You gold-bricker! On your feet, loser! And here I snatch the pillow from his hand and wind up as if to pillow him well into next week, when I remember that he is only a kid, and a smallish one at that. And it is on me as the man here to teach him, which would be better accomplished if I stitch him up in a potato sack and stash him in the cellar for a day or two until he calms down. But then I catch a glance at the clock on my orange crate nightstand, which reads a little after noon, and I have been out to the docks in Oakland and back already this morning. Kid, I say, it's only noon, and not the agreed-upon time of after three, and furthermore, why are you not in school? And finally, and do not think this item is less important because I bring it up last, but why in the hell are you standing on my bed with your dirty shoes? And the kid jumps off the bed and runs over to the heavy bag, which hangs in the hexagonal alcove of my small apartment, and starts pounding on the bag as he says, I took my shoes off before I jumped up there. And I look, and indeed, the kid wears no shoes, but has two socks so dirty as they might be knitted from mud, and from the front of each protrudes a once pink but now filth-burnished naked toe. In fact, the kid, from his toes to the top of his newsboy cap, is covered in a fine patina of street crime, as one might find in an unfortunate urchin in a Dickens novel. He could be 9 or he could be 12 years of age. I do not know, and I do not ask. But he is small and has the aspect of a very sour-faced little Jimmy Cagney. In short, he is a horrible little kid.
And it's summer, dummy, says the kid, so there's no school. But I have a message for you, so you can just pay me a bonus and don't try to hold out on me because my Uncle Bemis is a union man and he will knock the tar out of a mug for not paying an honest fella's wages. And I want to go to the pictures. There's a new one down at the Alhambra, with Bogey and that skinny doll from To Have and Have Not, and it's supposed to be shot right here on Telegraph Hill, so pay up or I won't tell you the message.
First, I don't know why the kid thinks I've tasked him with taking messages. He lives with his ma in my building, a Victorian with 6 apartments, a couple of blocks from Sal's, and he is always sitting on the stoop or loitering about the halls, while his ma is upstairs entertaining his various uncles. The kid's dad was killed in the war, and although I've never seen his ma, she seems to keep busy looking after various uncles. If she is not a professional, it is a safe bet that she is a very hard-working amateur. For all I know, the kid might have offed dear Ma and stashed her body in the icebox months ago. But that is unlikely, as the kid is entirely too small to accomplish the hydraulics of such a move, even if he is well-stocked with enthusiasm and bad intentions. Anyway, one morning, 2 years or so ago, I stumbled in around 7 a.m., having indulged perhaps more than recommended in the consumption of spirits and the construction of merriment, when I encounter the kid on the stairs as he's heading out for school. So I says to him, Look, kid, my alarm clock is on the bum, and I feel that I may be sleeping more than somewhat soundly today, as I am very tired. I need to make it to work at 4 this afternoon, so I'll give you 2 bits if you come up and wake me up when you get off from school, and do not leave until I am on my feet. Actually, my alarm clock is not on the bum, but I've been known to fling said clocks crashing to alarm clock Valhalla upon a certain morning after I've indulged in spirits, and since I am new on the job at Sal's, and it is soon after the war ends and jobs are in quite short supply, I need to make my punch in time. Well, the kid takes this as a permanent assignment,
And from that day on to this, he hits me up for 2 bits a day, for waking me up, as well as taking messages, screening visitors, coaching me on the heavy bag, and casting aspersions on the occasional lady friend who joins me for a sleepover, saying tramp and floozy to them as they leave in the morning, when they are at their most vulnerable. So even though the kid is horrible, he is almost an orphan. What with his pop deceased and his mother practicing her athletic pursuits, and I do not have the heart to tell him that the 2 bits for waking me up is a one-time thing that he has misinterpreted. I don't remember ever giving the kid a key, but evidently I did, and he refuses to give it back. Ever. "Come on," says the kid, whacking the heavy bag with his dirty little dukes. "What are you, some kind of cream puff? Give me 20 good minutes on this thing, and don't spare the gas." "What's the message, runt?" "Why, I'll bet my Uncle Davey could take you out in the first round, you macaroon." "A macaroon is a cookie, kid." "Nah, it ain't. You're a dirty liar." "What's the message, and who's it from?" "It's from that Nip cocksucker with the black and white shoes."
"Don't talk like that."
"What? Nip is just Nip for Jap."
"I meant the other thing, and he's Chinese, not Japanese. What's the message?"
"He said it tell you like this. The cheese is a biscuit slinger at the Five and Dime on Poke. What is that, some kind of Nip code? Why, my old man would have just popped that Jap cocksucker right on the spot if he wasn't dead."
"Yeah, I'm sure he would," I says, not really paying attention anymore. Why would Eddie drop by to tell me such a thing in the middle of the day? I am surprised, in fact, that he is even awake at such an hour. But why couldn't it wait? Maybe he feels bad about dragging me into that joint where I'm invited to sip snake whiz and touch an old Chinaman's dong, so he wants to make amends. What Moo doesn't know is that no amends are required, as they already have an angle on the snake whiz place which will make us a small fortune. Maybe.
"I'm telling you, that guy's a Jap spy," says the kid. "He couldn't even say squirrel. That's how they spotted spies in the war. If they can't say squirrel, you blast them."
"As Germans, they can't say squirrel."
"Yeah, well, he wouldn't say it no matter how much I threatened him. What's that tell you?"
"That you're a pest?"
"Yeah, what do you know, you bum? Sleep until noon."
"I'm supposed to be sleeping until 3, and I do not appreciate you giving my pals the third degree." Then the kid gives the heavy bag one last whack and pads over to my bedside with his hand out.
"Pay up. 2 bits to the message and 2 bits to the wake-up."
"You'll get nothing and you'll like it," I says. "Did you make coffee?"
"No, pay up."
So I sit up in bed, reach down, and grab his little run-down shoes from the floor. "Take these and get out." And the kid snatches the shoes from me and heads out.
"Fine, you welcher. You know, if I'd have known you were going to welch on my wages, I wouldn't have woken you up. I ain't even going to tell you what I heard in the radio."
"Don't use my radio," I tell him.
"Fine. I ain't even going to tell you that a guy saw a flying saucer up by Mount Rainier in Washington."
"Mount Rainier," I tell him.
"No, it ain't," says the kid. "You don't know. You weren't even listening. Probably Martians."
"There's no such thing as Martians, kid."
"Yeah, there is. They're coming to take our dames. You're a stinking liar."
"Fine," I says. "Go away."
"Fine," says the kid, hand on the doorknob. "I'm going to go see that bogey movie, and I ain't going to tell you a stinking thing about it. You can just suffer, you Nip sympathizer."
"Go," I says.
"I'm going," he says. "You can just sleep in and eat a pile of fish heads when you wake up."
"Fine," says I.
"Fine," says the kid, stepping into the hall. "And you're out of milk."
I keep some milk and cornflakes and bread and butter and stuff in the apartment in case the kid gets hungry.
"Fine," I says.
"Fine," says the kid, and he slams the door. I still have a few hours to sleep, and I can probably wake up to the alarm clock. So I have a quick whiz and return to bed with a towel to drape over my eyes against the unkind light of day. When I set the alarm clock, I tell it, "Sorry, pal, but this afternoon you may die for that little fucker's sins." Some 40 minutes walking to work because I go a mile out of my way to walk past the Five and Dime on Polk Street, which is not along the route of my normal 3-block sojourn to sales. I just walk by, and I can see there's a dame working the lunch counter, but she is not by any stretch the cheese, as she is red of hair and more than somewhat plain. Just the same, I walk the whole block without giving in to my limp, and I hold my walking stick like I'm a guy in a hurry, carrying an umbrella on a sunny day, or perhaps a deer slayer, padding through the forest with his bow in hand. Do I stop in and ask after Stilton to the red-haired dame? I do not. Do I leave word that Sammy from Sale stops by and please tell Stilton best wishes? I do not.
I just walk by. And as I go, I am thinking that I am a first-rate sap. What am I, 9 years old? I ask because I know this feeling. See, when I am 9, little more than a child myself, I fall in deepest, darkest love with a little doll called Molly Warner, who is in my third-grade class and has the most fetching brown bob hairdo, as well as a facility with long division, which I find, at the time, borders on the mystical. I am smitten to the deep end of my soul, and I express my love first by writing the aforementioned doll's name on little pieces of paper and eating them during class.